On January 25th, 2023, in a courthouse in South Carolina where the Murdoch name had garnered respect and deference for so many decades, the trial of the disgraced Alec Murdoch began. The trial lasted 28 days with more than 70 witnesses, including Alec Murdoch, who had to testify in order to explain to the jury why he had consistently lied to the police about being with Paul and Maggie just moments before their deaths. I'm Marina. With me, I have my best friend, Laura, and this is Grimm.
Part trois.
Un, deux, trois. Before we start, I just want to say thank you to all of our gremlins for their love and support. We know you guys have all missed Colby and felt her absence, as have we, and you guys have all had nothing but kind words and well wishes for Colby and for Laura and I. And Laura and I did not make the decision to start releasing episodes every other week lightly. And again, we've been met with nothing but support and kind words, mm-hmm. and it means literally the world to us. You guys are the best, and you all know this is a labor of love for us, and we just want to ensure that we continue to deliver the quality content you have come to know and love, while also ensuring that Laura and I do not burn out and cry.
Yeah, I thought you were just going to say die, because I think that would be the result. It is. It's a lot. I mean, you guys probably all figure out, but we have full-time careers, not just jobs that we kind of would rather, well, although sometimes we'd rather be doing this, but, you know, we work really hard in our careers, and we're, if I do say so myself, we're pretty darn successful. And it's really important that we maintain focus and energy there. But we do also love doing this. And like you said, we love making sure that it's well-researched, making sure that we're putting thought into it and that they're enjoyable cases. And that's a lot of work. So
it is. But just thank you, guys. Yeah. Like, it really means a lot to us that you didn't come out with pitchforks and torches at our decision. So we love you.
We love you.
So for this case, for the third and final time, I'm going to tell you that I watched The Murdoch Murders, a Southern Scandal on Netflix.
Wait, is that what this is about?
It is.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm in the wrong place.
I know, right? I also listened to a lot of the trial testimony. There was a podcast called The Trial of Alec Murdoch. Ooh. It had like a red logo. It looked spooky.
That's so much better than the blue one.
But they also had interviews and stuff. So, and somebody recommended it to me, and I was like, oh, I'll listen to it if it's not like, you know, 100 episodes. And it was like 350. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. Was it like an episode on every person's sentence?
It was the parts of the trial testimony, but then it was also recaps of it and interviews with other people and forensic people. Like, there's just a million bajillion episodes. That's so cool. That was pretty cool. You should listen to that. I did not listen to all 400 episodes. I did my best. I did my best.
I know you did.
Same thing with the trial. I wish I could have listened to every second of it, but I just unfortunately couldn't fit 28 days of court hearings into my current schedule.
You mean in addition to the ones you already do?
Yes, yes. In addition to my regular normal court, I couldn't fit 28 days more of court.
Okay, that's fair.
And then I watched the two Dateline specials, which were called Dark Waters and The Trial of Alec Murdoch, and then gazillion bajillion articles. Mm-hmm. I couldn't write them all down, like just a bajillion.
And I know I gave this shout out, I think, in part two, but just the fact that you've pulled together three, well, I guess I can't say how
this
good
one's
this
garbage.
One is.
Just garbage.
I was gonna say really good ones, but really like full, in-depth, really interesting cases. So interesting. I just appreciate you.
Thank you.
I just want you to do all the cases. I really like when you tell them.
Well, I have another 12 pages for you.
Perfect. I'm ready.
Okay. So when we last left off, Alec was already in jail for several financial crimes. And then on July 14th, 2022, he was indicted with two counts of murder for the deaths of Maggie and Paul. He pleaded not guilty at his bond hearing on July 20th, and his lawyer said that he wanted to go to trial as soon as possible. Before he even got to the murder trial, Alec racked up a few more charges. In December 2022, he was indicted on 9 counts of tax evasion for failing to report almost $7 million in income from 2011 to 2019.
Oh my, that's so many taxes.
He owed the federal government almost $500,000 in taxes.
Actually less than I thought.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what they say, the only thing in life that's certain is death and taxes.
That's what this whole case is about.
Death and taxes. That's also the Lori Vallow case. That was all death and taxes.
True.
Those indictments were in addition to the 90 plus charges he already faced for defrauding victims almost out of $10 million.
Is that
out of almost $10 million? Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Lots of words. Mm-hmm. Is 90 charges a lot? It seems like a lot.
It's a lot. Yeah. Okay. It's a few. That's a few charges.
It seems like more than one.
It's more than one, more than two even.
Wow.
It's a lot.
That's a lot.
Jury selection in the murder trial started only 6 months after his indictment in January 2023, which is pretty fast. Mm. Pretty fast. He was officially being prosecuted for 2 counts of murder and 2 counts of possession of a weapon during the commission of a violent crime for both Maggie and Paul. Hmm. And I mentioned in the opening that the Murdoch family had previously been kings in the 14th Circuit Courts. Now, before the trial started, they had to remove a picture of Alex's grandfather from the courtroom wall.
Interesting.
Awkward.
That's crazy. And like, what did they think was gonna happen? The jurors were like, there's a family resemblance here.
His name was probably on the plaque underneath the picture.
That's crazy.
Awkward. Yeah.
You remember when we used to do Awkward Turtle?
Mm-hmm. So at trial, the state was represented by lead prosecutor Creighton Waters, which doesn't that sound like it would be the Southern prosecutor in a novel?
Yes.
Creighton Waters. He worked for the South Carolina Attorney General's office for more than 24 years. The Attorney General's office was involved in the prosecution in lieu of the solicitor's office because Duffy Stone, the current solicitor, recused himself from the case on August 11th, 2021, based on a conflict.
I thought maybe that's where you were going.
Yeah. The timing coincides with that third Sled interrogation, at which point Sled was focusing on Alec as the lead suspect.
And so, in case you're like me and forgot what Sled was, it was highly confused.
South Carolina Law Enforcement Division.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Alec was represented by Dick Harpootlian, who had 30 years of trial experience as a prosecutor, defense attorney, and civil litigator. He's also a state lawmaker and former chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. He was co-chair with Jim Griffin, who was previously an assistant U.S. attorney in the District of South Carolina. So they sound impressive.
To me, at least.
They sound smart. The trial began with opening statements, which we don't have in Connecticut. But like closing statements, the state gets to go first because they have the burden of proof. So they get to set the scene for the jury. The opening arguments are like a roadmap for what each side intends to prove and argue.
That is a very helpful description. And I know you've told us that before, but still just is strange to me that we don't have, that you just wouldn't have opening arguments.
I know.
Opening statements.
I think it makes a little bit of sense, though, because you could say something in the opening argument that doesn't end up playing out at trial. Mm. If you say like something that ends up getting excluded or just doesn't pan out, and now the jury's wondering about it, or they clung to it. That's and they're like, fair. I remember that happening. So at least with closing arguments, now you know what got into evidence and you can create a synopsis of all that evidence. Sure. So I guess I could see it, but I think opening arguments are great because you're telling the story in advance so that the jurors understand what you're trying to elicit from these witnesses. Yeah.
I like the concept that it's a roadmap for what to expect, especially after our last legal corner, learning really how much burden the jurors have to evaluate what's happening, to understand what's happening and in a place that they typically wouldn't. So
correct. So Prosecutor Creighton Waters did a great job, in my opinion, in his opening. He left a lot to the imagination, but he gave the jury the roadmap of what he intended to prove. He explained the crime scene in less graphic terms than the defense, ironically, and then started chipping away at Alec's credibility right out of the gates, noting that he lied about being at the dog kennels minutes before Maggie and Paul's deaths, and then questioned the timeline of his actions that night before calling 911. The state concluded that the circumstances in Alec's life leading up to June 7th were a perfect storm that came to a head and resulted in Alec killing Maggie and Paul. The defense's strategy out of the gates was to humanize Alec for the jury. Motive was a big issue in this case, and the question everyone was asking was, why would Alec do this? DeCarputlian says right away, "It's an honor and a privilege to represent Alec, a loving husband and a loving father incapable of the crimes with which he was charged." The defense then went on to try to describe the crimes in such a way that someone could not imagine a loving father doing such a thing to his son. I can see why they went with this approach, but I think they took that thread a little too far in some instances, and my mouth was actually wide open listening to
No way.
Here's just an example.
Oh, boy.
Dick said, in reference to Paul, "The second shot ended up, and will be some question about the direction of that shot, but ended up entering his skull cavity, and the gases from that shot really exploded his head like a watermelon hit with a sledgehammer."
Oh my God.
"All that was left was the front of his face. Everything else was gone. His brain exploded out of his head, hit the ceiling in the shed, and dropped to his feet. Horrendous, horrible butchering. So to find Alec Murdoch guilty of murdering his son, you're going to have to accept that within an hour of having an extraordinary bonding. You can see it in the Snapchat that he executes him in a brutal fashion. Not believable. Not believable."
I'm with you on I see the angle they were going for.
My God.
But I don't think that that helped.
A watermelon with a sledgehammer in reference to a human head.
To your client's son.
Your client's son's human head.
Wow.
What a horrifying analogy.
It's extremely colorful depiction.
Really, it paints a word. He paints a word picture. It is. Horrifying.
But wow. I'm assuming the jury's reaction was much like yours.
A gape. Mm-hmm. Aghast. Yeah.
Yes.
He wasn't done with the imagery.
Oh.
He said later, "Let me give you another fact. You're going to hear the witnesses explain the catastrophic injuries to Paul. His head literally exploded, and whoever shot him was probably no more than 3 feet away. Maybe closer. Maybe a little further away. His head exploded. You'd be covered in blood from head to foot. In blood. They seized his clothes that night. Sled did. And they, first of all, you'll see in the videos from the officers that arrived that night, there's no blood on him. They didn't find any blood on him."
Right, because he changed.
You can see what they're getting at again. But like, for the average person to hear about like a carry level of blood showering from this
carry level
watermelon sledgehammer situation, like that's jarring.
It is, and it actually reminds me of, I was trying to think which case it was. I think it was Eileen Warnos, where that was actually also the defenses, where it was so, now I don't remember which one it was. Maybe it was not that, but that they were going for, it's such an intense, awful death that it couldn't possibly have been her. But it had the exact opposite effect.
Right. And that's the only problem. If it backfires on you, as soon as it switches over, they're like, oh, well, fuck this guy. Because his son's head with the watermelon and sledgehammer.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know,
and that's all they have in their mind.
The defense tried to get ahead of the dog kennel issue up front in the opening statements. Regarding the timing, Dick said that the cell phone records indicated Alec had less than 10 minutes to commit the murders, get to the house, get in his car, and leave. And if that were the timing, Alec would be covered in blood. Then they try to say that Alec never really had an alibi. The evidence is consistent with Alec seeing Maggie and Paul earlier at the dog pen. And by the way, that audio they have of him and Maggie, they were talking about one of the dogs killing a chicken. They were debating whether it was a guinea hen or chicken. No animosity. Very normal discussion. The defense then focused a lot on the standard of proof, the state's burden, and stated several times that Alec Murdoch is presumed innocent.
Hold on, I have a question. When you said that the defense was talking about Alec not having an alibi, wouldn't that be the prosecution who would be saying they don't have an alibi?
I don't know that I fully get into this. There was testimony about it, but the state was arguing that Alec tried to set up an alibi with phone calls and the timing of things. And the defense was saying, nope, he just had this normal night. It's just the way it played out. He didn't have an alibi.
Okay,
that's
it.
A great question.
Which is actually my biggest fear. If I'm just like at home watching TikTok, well, then maybe you could look on my phone, but still. Like,
you can.
And then, I don't know, things like that make me nervous. Or I was taking a nap. I don't know, like by myself.
Can anybody verify that?
I know, it's scary.
I know. After opening arguments, the state presented its case first. Again, because they have the burden to prove the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Prosecution called 61 witnesses and introduced 500 pieces of evidence over the first 17 days of trial. That is a whole lot of lawyering.
Holy moly. How do you even have 61 people talking about this?
There's a lot of people. It's
crazy.
So many people. I actually remember a time, I think I was an intern in law school, and my husband showed up to a trial for us to listen to testimony. And for like an hour, they were talking about when this man peed in the morning. They were like, was it when you got up from in the morning? Is that when you normally go to the bathroom? What about when did you next go to the bathroom? And he was like, I'm all set. Like, how is this real life?
I get it. Cause like, yeah. I know a lot of it is like on technicality and on the details and all that. But I would crack under pressure. Even if I weren't guilty, I'd be like, I don't know what time I pee. Define pee.
Like, what do you mean? One drop, a waterfall? Yeah. I don't know.
Did I think about peeing? Maybe. I don't know.
Okay, so Laura, don't testify. Don't testify. Please.
It would be so bad.
Okay, so I'm going to apologize in advance if any of this discussion is a bit choppy. That's sort of the nature of the beast with trial testimony, because each witness presents facts or evidence and the state or defense can seek to weave in to a coherent story. So it may be a little choppy. If you have any questions, feel free to interrupt me.
I will.
So the state started by presenting the officers who were first on the scene. The state called Sergeant Daniel Green, who was wearing the body camera, as well as SLED Special Agent David Owen, who was the one who had interviewed Alec on the three occasions. The state clung to something in an interview that they felt was a confession. When Agent Owen interviewed Alec in the car on June 10th, 2021, Alec broke down and said something that sounded like, "It's just so bad, I did him so bad." The defense attorneys argued on cross-examination that's not what he said. During the trial, defense attorneys slowed down the interview and argued that he actually said, "It's just so bad, they did him so bad." I'm actually going to play the regular speed clip of it for you, and you can tell me what you hear.
Oh, boy.
It's just so bad. It's so bad.
What did you hear?
A did it so bad.
I get it.
I can hear it's like Laurel and Yanni.
I wrote that down. It's like one of those social media experiments where you hear whatever word you're waiting to hear.
I can hear both ways.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna play the slowed down version for you.
Okay. First of all, that's creepy as fuck. Real creepy. Second, his voice is so much higher, and I meant to say this in the first one, than I expected. Mm-hmm. Like several octaves higher
than I expected. It made me think of Robert Wone when that guy called 911 yes. and they were like, ma'am, calm down.
Oh, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
And third, I do feel like it's they.
I heard they on the very slowed down, but in real life. And you know what's interesting is the defense attorney said, "Did you hear they then?" And he's like, "No, sir, I still heard I," or you know, "I'm just telling you what I thought I heard." And the defense attorney was like, "Well, that's up to the jury, right?" It's literally up to the jury to decide what he said. It's up to them. If they say he said they, that's what he said.
If they say I, pronouns right now.
I know. I said a lot of words.
They, I.
Yeah. You knew what I meant though.
I did. Wow, though. I mean, and even if he said they, I'm not sure. I guess that takes away the possibility of it being a confession, but I don't think it exonerates him. Like, he still could have meant, like, how they were treated. I don't know. There's a million things he could have meant. I don't know.
Even if he said I don't think it's necessarily a confession.
No.
Could have just been like he wasn't there when it happened.
Yeah.
Like I did him so bad.
So we'll just disregard that piece of evidence. I don't think we can do that, but I will.
Throw it out. I'm throwing it out.
It's done. I don't like it. It doesn't help me.
And I thought you might like this. I wrote this down. This is a little grim legal corner fact for anyone who doesn't know.
I definitely don't know.
It's relatively generic, but I just didn't know if you would know this. The party that calls the witness questions them first, and it's called direct examination.
Mm-hmm.
And then the opponent cross-examines the witness. And then on direct examination, you're not supposed to ask leading questions. You're supposed to ask questions like, then what happened? And what did you see? Whereas on cross-examination, you're like, and then you went in there and you saw him hovering over the bloody body, didn't you? See, really? Do you see the difference in those two questions?
I did, but I didn't know. Mm-hmm. I wonder what the rationale for that is. Because you're not...
Because it's your witness. Yeah, you're trying not to put words in their mouth.
Got it. Oh, so I really appreciate you doing this entire part because it's allowing me to live out my fantasy of being a lawyer without actually doing any of the work to become a lawyer, and for that I thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, skipping LSATs in the law school.
It's really
in the law school.
10 out of 10 would recommend.
100%. Yep. So as I mentioned earlier, the defense brought up in the opening that Paul's head exploded, but that Alec didn't have a drop of blood on him, so he must not have done it. The state's argument was that Alec had time to clean up.
Mm-hmm. And was in a crisp white shirt when he was found. So yes, I think that that's very likely.
Super crisp.
Yes, like our audience.
In Paul's Snapchat video around 7:30, the one where Alec was trying to fix that fruit tree, he was in a blue button-down shirt, khaki pants, and brown boat shoes. The state called the Murdochs' current housekeeper as a witness, and they testified that the shoes in the video were nowhere to be found since the murder. Because those are probably harder to clean than clothes, right? So maybe Alec changed out of the bloodstained clothing, and or maybe he was also wearing a raincoat.
That would be incredible forethought.
The state called Shelley Smith, Alec's mother's caretaker, and she testified that 2 weeks after the murders, Alec showed up in the early morning hours with what Shelley thought was a bright blue balled-up tarp. She said he brought the tarp upstairs and she didn't see it again. Investigators searched Alec's mother's house and found a balled-up bright blue raincoat in the closet upstairs. They seized it and it tested positive for gunshot residue.
My jaw is hanging open. I thought you were kidding.
No.
About that. Oh my God. That is so cold and like calculating.
I know. And I don't know if I don't know if he was actually wearing a raincoat. No. You would think there'd be more forensic evidence on it if that was the case. But why was he hiding a balled up raincoat in his family's closet weeks later?
And they didn't say that they found blood on it, though.
No.
Would you have if he like rinsed it off and put bleach on it or whatever you do?
I think it depends. It depends. Allegedly.
It appears that
there could have been blood on it.
I guess he could have, like, they do hunt and all that stuff. I guess that's not that weird to have.
That's the problem too that's the problem with the gunshot residue on like anything they own, because they hunt all the time. And if you don't clean your guns that often, and there was much to do about all of this, I couldn't get into every piece of it. It'd be 87 parts.
And coming next week is part 4. Just kidding.
In addition to cleaning up himself, the state insinuated that Alec cleaned up the crime scene as well. The state called Dale Davis to testify concerning water pooled in the dog kennels. Dale Davis lived down the road and was responsible for caring for the Murdoch family dogs and kennels. He testified that there was water at the crime scene pooled in places that it shouldn't be. Dale was meticulous and knew where each dog went in the kennels and where water would be after he washed them. And he also said it was unusual for water to pool in the kennels at all during the summer when it was so warm. He noted that he had made especially sure that water didn't pool near the feed room where Paul was found because the wood wasn't sealed and would rot out from the moisture.
Love this guy, by the way, that he is that has meticulous. That much attention to detail and taking care of the dogs. I really appreciate that.
We love a dog person. After he would clean up the kennels, Dale also had a particular way to roll up the hose so that it wasn't kinked. In the crime scene photos taken after the murders, Dale reviewed them and said that the hose was not how he hung it up because there was pressure on the hose and he's much more careful than that.
I believe that.
But then also in the Snapchat video that the state used to kill, no pun intended, Alec's alibi, it showed that hose was haphazardly strewn on the ground.
Already.
Okay. So then who hung it up? Because that video was at like 8:45.
And they're not doing anything that would use hoses, right?
Right. Well, I mean, I guess they could have been cleaning the kennels again or like hosing something off. So who hung it back up?
When you said in the last part that there was something about hoses with Alec. I quite literally had no idea what you were talking about. Is this, I think this is what you were referring to.
I was.
Okay.
I was. Dale also testified that the dogs were in different kennels from when he left that afternoon. And then there was a moment in the 911 call where it sounded like Alec said here, like he was calling to a dog, but he denied that he ever got any of the dogs out of the kennels. So there was really
so bizarre,
like this focus on like who did what with the hoses and the dogs, yeah, and the timing of it all. It's just super bizarre. And the only thing I can wonder was Alec washing blood off of his raincoat and himself outside with the hose after the fact. Like maybe,
right,
maybe Paul took the hose off for some reason and then Alec used it to rinse himself off. And then he, and the crime scene. And then he, like, why would he wash the crime scene off if he's saying there's a vigilante involved? Also, so it had to be off, yeah, himself, right? I mean, it had to be.
Yes. And like, if you've ever tried to wash like anything outside with a hose, like it's not, it doesn't just disappear. There would be blood in the water.
There was.
Oh. Okay.
There was blood everywhere.
Oh, well, there you go. No, but it's still, I mean, it still could just be a red herring. Like, it's just a weird thing, but doesn't actually have anything to do with it. I don't know. I don't know the answers.
I had to include it because, yeah, there was a big to-do about the hoses and the dogs. And unfortunately, Sled didn't test any shower or sink drains for blood, because they indicated that people shed bodily fluids every day.
Okay. I guess if you can't do by volume or anything.
Right.
But it is, with all that being said about the hose situation, it does introduce doubt, right? Like it does make you think like, that's weird. Could someone else have been there? Could something else have happened? So
I don't, right,
know. I would be a terrible juror. I really would.
Who hung up the hose?
I don't know. I think like, I've also seen tactics from, in the cases I've done, that is, I've also seen tactics where the defense just tries to show that it's not necessarily that it's not the defendant, but that maybe there was someone else involved. That was also an Eileen Wuornos thing where it, like, they wanted to introduce enough doubt that maybe someone else was involved and that should be enough to not have met the burden of proof.
Right.
So anyway.
The hose just makes no sense to me based on the, yeah, timing, which I'm going to talk about the timing a little bit more later. But when the video was shot showing the hose on the haphazardly, yeah, on the ground, they're saying that they died not long thereafter. So it's like what they shot the video. He hung the hose up and then he died. Like,
yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. It's probably not even that important.
That's what I mean.
And you know, yeah, what's funny? And, yeah, like, Alec probably did it. And he, can you imagine having committed a crime that you're actually being tried for, that you're maintaining your innocence, and you're just sitting there and you're like, got that wrong. You guys are like totally looking at the wrong thing. Oh, can you imagine?
It would kill me. I'd be like, but that's not what it is. I didn't use it for that.
I hung the hoses up.
Yeah.
It would kill me.
Yep.
Okay, so the question on everyone's mind was, why did Alec do this?
Yeah.
Especially given the dearth of physical evidence against him.
Great word.
Thank you. A big win for the prosecution was the ruling that they would be permitted to introduce evidence of Alec's financial misconduct to help prove motive over the defendant's objection. Typically, such evidence wouldn't be allowed to be admitted because it could be prejudicial if it were being used to show that Alec had a criminal tendency or bad character. The court heard days of testimony from witnesses, including Mallory Beach's attorney, Mark Tinsley, about Alec's financial mess without the jury present, so that the judge had a preview of the evidence the state intended to present. Mm-hmm. The state argued that the witnesses were key to show that Alec killed his family to buy himself time.
Mm.
The defense objected, arguing that the state was just trying to smear Alec's name because they didn't have enough evidence to convict him of the killings. They argued that it was absurd to think that a lawyer would think additional scrutiny in his life would be diminished by a double homicide. Which, I mean, they sort, yeah, of have a point, fair, there.
Yeah.
The judge ultimately ruled that he agreed with prosecutors that this evidence fell under an important exception because it went to Alec's alleged motive. Specifically, the judge said that, I find that the jury is entitled to consider that the apparent desperation of Mr. Murdoch because of his dire financial situation, the threat of being exposed for committing the crimes which he was later charged with, resulted in the commission of the alleged crimes. It is so intimately connected with and explanatory of the crime charged that proof of it is essential to complete the story.
It does. I actually followed all of that.
Wonderful.
It is in...
Is it interesting?
It's interesting that you can't bring in evidence that is like talking about someone's criminal behavior and character, because I just feel like that should be allowed to come in.
It depends. There are exceptions.
Yeah.
So you can bring in evidence of prior crimes involving deceit, fraud, stuff like that. It goes to the defendant's credibility. Mm-hmm. And then in sexual assault cases, you can do the prior, you can even do prior uncharged misconduct to show that there's like a pattern of that behavior.
Yeah. Okay. Because so, that's more what I'm thinking.
Yeah. There's certain exceptions, but basically, normally you can't be like, this guy is a piece of shit thief, so he killed his family.
Right.
Oh, that's what they're trying to avoid.
Back to the Murdoch case, though. I'm surprised that that's the motive they're going with. I guess I did have that question too. It sure seems like he's guilty just based on what we've talked about for what happened, but I do have a hard time with what the motive is. I don't know. Cause it's all tied back in with the boat accident, but that's I guess that's like, maybe if Paul's dead, you can't sue Alec. I don't know.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I think that's the better. We can discuss it more we've gotten all of the information out. Mm. But I agree with you. I think that there may be more to it. Mm. And I think there's more to Alec being a sociopath and making a rash decision. But then there's also some evidence that it was precalculated. So I don't know.
The raincoat. I'm just kidding.
Possibly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so one of the witnesses the state called to discuss the financial crimes and support their theory of Alec's motives was Jeannie Seckinger, the chief financial officer for the Pimped Law Firm. I'm going to keep calling it that. The Barker Law Group now. Yep. Now it's called. She said that she confronted Alec on June 7th, 2021 about missing legal fees the day that Maggie and Paul died. She said the conversation was short because it was interrupted by a personal phone call that Alec took about his father's ailing health. Now, the motive is a little sketchy because who would think that it would work for everyone to back off when this happened?
Right.
But it did for a little bit. Huh. After the murders, the law firm put a pause on the investigation because they were worried about Alec and his mental health.
Hmm.
And the same momentary pause happened in the boat case as well.
That's true. There are other ways to get people to be concerned about your mental health than killing your wife and son. Just
very true.
Just saying.
Very true. Mm-hmm. After Paul and Maggie's murder, attorney Mark Tinsley considered dropping the lawsuit on behalf of the Beach family. He didn't feel that Alec was capable of killing his wife and son, and he felt that if Alec was the victim of vigilante justice, then the case would have been over.
Huh.
He said he would have taken whatever they offered him because no jury would return a verdict against him or Buster after such tragedy.
Huh.
But then attorney Tinsley realized that was exactly what Alec had wanted. There was no vigilante seeking revenge, just a desperate, desperate man.
Oof.
Alec's life was about to fall apart with financial problems and legal issues looming, so he killed Paul and Maggie to buy himself time. That's the theory.
Huh.
The state also called a forensic accountant who testified that Murdoch didn't have enough money in his bank accounts or elsewhere to pay several debts or possible lawsuit judgments that were hanging over his head the day of the murders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Alec's friend and fellow attorney, Chris Wilson, who we talked about in part two, he testified about the money that Alec stole from him and that he admitted to needing the money to fund an opioid addiction. The state presented evidence that Paul had called Alex about a month before his death on May 6, 2021, and left him a voicemail that said that Maggie found bags of pills in his computer bag and that they had to talk. And Maggie's phone showed that she had Googled white pill 30 on one side RP that same day.
Ugh.
On May 7th, the next day, Alec texted Maggie and said, "I'm very sorry to do this to all of you. I love you."
Wait, Paul? Maggie found the stuff in Paul's bag?
Alec's bag, and Paul texted Alec and said, "We have to talk. Oh. Maggie found the pills in your bag."
Oh, okay.
So it seems certain that Alec did actually have an addiction. I remember there was a comment, I think it was on one of the Dateline specials, and it was an interesting point. It's like this very small town where everybody talks and everybody knows everybody's business. Like, no one knew about this secret addiction. Like, how did word not get around? But then I also saw articles that said that opioid addiction can hide in plain sight.
Absolutely. And like, he probably knew that there would have been a lot of talk in the town and probably didn't buy it in town. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, obviously he knew that. So
instead he bought it from Curtis Eddie Smith, who he said shot him in the head. You know.
Yes, that.
According to the Netflix documentary, though, it would take 114 years to consume $10 million worth of oxy pills.
Oh, I hadn't thought about the math with that.
Yeah, and Alex said that he was buying up to $60,000 a week of oxy pills, and that would buy 750 of the best pills at $80 each, which, according to the Googs, normally go for like $20 to $25 a piece. Oh, my God. That's a lot of oxy. Yeah,
so, okay. Mm-hmm.
And he did say, he said that he, there were some days he took up to 60 pills a day, that it depended on the milligrams.
That's so much.
A lot. Yikes. It's a lot.
We need Colby here for
to break down the metrics. Yeah. It's a lot. That's a lot of oxy.
Wow.
I know. Anyone who has ever played to hunt a killer will know the key to finding the killer is to look for means, motive, and opportunity.
Yes. Or if they've played Clue.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sled already knew that Paul and Maggie were murdered with family guns, which is the means. Mm-hmm. The state called expert witnesses who testified that the blackout shells near Maggie's body matched the shells that were on the family shooting range. And the gun that was likely used to shoot Maggie was allegedly lost by Paul. But there was testimony that it was seen as late as April 2021 by friends who hunted with Paul. They also established testimony concerning how Paul and Maggie were killed. Dr. Kenneth Kinsey, an Orangeburg County Sheriff's deputy and crime scene expert, testified that Paul was standing in the doorway of the feed room when he was shot. Paul's arms were down, indicating that he didn't feel threatened by the shooter and or he may have been ambushed by the first shot. Mm. There were no defensive wounds or evidence of any defensive movements, and the impact of the second shot to his head was so fatal that any movement was just due to gravity. Based upon the angles, the shooter was standing about 3 feet away to the right of the door, and the shot was fired upwards, spraying blood onto the door of the feed room.
Was he must have been facing away. Oh, no.
But no, he was facing the shooter.
Oh, okay.
And then Paul's body fell forward, face down onto the ground outside of the feed room.
Wow.
Maggie likely faced her killer, backing up into the family's ATV before turning to run because she had tread marks on her body, but they said she wasn't run over by the ATV. Whoa. So they think she just bumped into it.
Crazy.
Maggie was shot 2 to 3 times in the thigh and abdomen from a distance of 4 to 5 feet. These shots caused Maggie to fall to her hands and her knees.
Oh.
And then the first fatal shot went through her abdomen, through her breast, jaw, and into her brain. Oof. While she was on her hands and knees.
Oof.
And then she was shot again in the crown of her head.
My God. Brutal. Intent to kill, to say the least.
Right. Brutal.
Wow.
And Alec asked multiple times if they suffered. Like, did he think to the cops? That he was like, you know, so do you think that they suffered at all?
Huh. I am just like ping pong in my head. Like, on one hand, I'm like, if he's guilty, then he's thinking, oh my God, did I make them suffer? I wanted it to be quick. But if he's not, like, if he didn't do it, he's wondering just what happened to his wife and son. I just like keep going back and forth. I can't land on one.
I very much think he did it.
Okay.
If that makes you feel any better.
It does make me feel better. I try not to jump. I mean, it's partially how you present the evidence to me too, because obviously I didn't sit through all of it. But I guess I try not to go to the obvious. Like, it sure seems like he did it.
Right.
I try to think about both sides, but
Right. Yes,
that I see that.
Mm, I agree with you.
Yeah.
As we discussed, the motive was to detract attention from himself and his financial crimes and opportunity.
Mm.
The state established that by absolutely demolishing Alec's timeline of events and ruining his credibility in the process.
Yep.
Alec had always been consistent in his timeline of events that evening. He came home from work, hung out with Paul, ate dinner with the fam, fell asleep on the couch, went to see his mom, came home at 10, and found Maggie and Paul.
Right.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
He was adamant that he did not go down to the kennels that night after dinner, and that the last time he saw Maggie and Paul was at dinner. And the state introduced the damning Snapchat video found on Paul's phone, the one referenced by Rogan Gibson, Alec's best friend, that Alec was asked about back on August 11th.
Mm-hmm.
The Snapchat video was taken from Paul's phone at 8:44 p.m. And in the background, you can hear Alec say, "Come here, Bubba," talking to one of the dogs.
Mm.
The state called several people close to the family to the witness stand who all confirmed that was Alec's voice in the video.
Wow.
And the timeline was shattered.
Uh-huh.
Along with his credibility. Yep. I mean, come on.
Yeah, because then you're now blatantly lying. You're not like, oh, I forgot, you know, I ate eggs instead of toast for breakfast. Like,
right.
You blatantly lied about where you were literally that day. Like, and significantly.
Not only that, they asked you, like, before he saw the video, they were like, somebody said they heard you on a video. Like, are you sure you weren't down there?
Oh.
And he was like, nope, don't know who that must have been, but it wasn't me.
Wow.
And to make matters worse for Alec, the state introduced evidence to establish that Maggie and Paul were likely murdered in the next 5 or so minutes Oof. Following that video. The state called SLED Lieutenant Britt Dove, who testified that Paul read the final text on his phone at 8:48:59. 36 seconds later, another text came in that he never read.
Oh, I literally have chills from that.
It's so bizarre to think about.
And like you said, like, it's insane to me that I'm feeling bad for Paul, given all of the other things we talked about. But I just imagine standing there thinking it's just a normal night. I'm just taking a Snapchat video. I'm checking my texts. And then the next minute, your head is a watermelon.
Right.
Oof. Oof.
With a sledgehammer. Oof.
Mm-hmm.
And Maggie's phone showed that she last read a text 28 seconds later. About 5 minutes after Maggie read the final text, the data showed her cell phone camera turned on for a second, which may have indicated that someone was trying to unlock her iPhone using Face ID.
Oh, or that, like, maybe she bumped it or something. Like, I accidentally send it to camera all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Lieutenant Dove also read a text from Maggie to someone that indicated that Alec wanted her to come home that day. Maggie's sister Marion Proctor's testimony confirmed that fact. She testified that on the day of the murders, Maggie hadn't planned to go to Mazelle that night. The only reason she was there was because Alec called her and asked her to come home because his father was terminal.
Oh my goodness.
That was the last time Marion spoke to her sister, and she was visibly upset when she said that she had actually encouraged her to go be with Alec that night.
I mean, how would you ever think that that was what the outcome was going to be? Of course you're going to do that. Oh,
that's like, but the premeditation is what I'm saying.
Yes, I know. I
hate that. She testified that after the murders, her and the rest of the family were terrified that Alec and Buster would be targeted, but she said that Alec never seemed worried.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The state also relied heavily on tech data from Alec's phone and from the data pulled from his Suburban to lay out a timeline inconsistent to his tales to the police.
Oh.
Agent Peter Rudofsky of SLED reviewed all of the data obtained and put together a detailed timeline of Alec's night, and I think he said it took him like a year.
Oh,
to do
my God.
To do it. I don't know if that's 8 hours a day for a year or like just you worked on it a couple hours a day, you know?
Still.
Insane. Agent Rudofsky testified that Alec's phone was silent for about an hour starting at 8 p.m. Between 9:02 and 9:06, Alex took 283 steps. So the state said he was a busy guy at that time.
Oh my God. I didn't even think about, like, because this is so recent that, like, our phones are tracking. We know everything. Holy moly.
It's bringing me back to the Fitbit murder.
Yes.
At 9:07, he was in his Suburban headed to his mother's house. Maggie's phone had been missing after her murder, but they located it on the side of the road using the Find My iPhone feature. It was the same road that Alec was traveling on to get to his mother's house, and he was traveling about 42 miles per hour as he neared the location where her phone was found, and then he sped up to 72 miles per hour after passing that spot.
Stop. Okay. Okay, this is definitely reminding me of Fitbit murder. Right.
Wow. The data that exists it just blows my mind. Alec got to his mother's house at 9:22 p.m. and was gone by 9:43, driving back to Moselle at a max speed of 80 miles per hour.
Dude, chill.
Shelley Smith, Alec's mother's caretaker, who testified about the blue tarp or rain jacket, she provided testimony that also impacted Alec's timeline. She said that Alec got to his mother's house around 9:20, which was a weird time for him to visit her. She said he was acting strangely and that he was only there for about 15 minutes and that his mother was asleep the whole time. She said the following week, Alec came back and was talking to her and was trying to coach her to say that he'd been there for 30 to 40 minutes on that night.
I was thinking exactly that's why he was going there, to be like, yeah, I totally did go to my mom's.
Right.
Oh.
That's the point of like the alibi.
Wow.
He was like trying to establish an alibi.
Wow.
And Alec had told the police he'd been there about 45 minutes to an hour. So about 20 minutes after he arrived, Alec leaves his mother's house at 9:43 and races back to Mazelle. Alec's Suburban pulled up to the kennels at 10:05, and 20 seconds later, he called 911. The state made it a point to remind the jury that Alec said he pulled up, saw Paul and Maggie's body, checked them both, and then called 911. And,
like, moved Paul's cell phone out of his pocket. He tried to turn him over,
and it fell out of his pocket.
Yeah.
That's a lot to get done in 20 seconds.
Yeah, man's efficient.
Wow. How many steps did he take in 20 seconds? Yeah,
really?
Wow. The state also pointed out that the maximum speed that Alec drove on his way to and from work that day was less than 55 miles per hour, but he was driving 80 miles per hour
mm-hmm.
back to Mazelle.
Mm-hmm. And then he had things to do.
Yeah, and they also had one of the officers testify that this was like a dark road that hadn't been newly paved, and that there were deer that would jump out, and that they would never be driving that fast on that road.
No. I see why you're in the guilty camp. Wow.
It's not a good look for him. It's not a good look for him. The state rested its case after Agent Rudofsky. And can we just pause for a second and talk about how insane the technology is? Uh-huh. I mean, that the state can pinpoint the average speed that you're driving throughout your day and the GPS coordinates. And, like, they'd be like, oh, okay, when he was at this spot, he was traveling 43 miles per hour. And the average from this stretch mm-hmm. to that stretch was a max of this and a min of that. And the one thing I'll say, though, I have to give this to Alec. He did not Google how to murder family to avoid jail time for tax evasion and theft.
Okay.
I've got to give it to him.
Hey, Gremlins, listen and learn. If you're going to commit a murder, perhaps leave your phone at home.
Yes.
In one spot. Just leave it alone.
I wrote that the lesson to learn here is don't kill people because you'll get caught and go to jail. Oh, but I guess if you're going to kill people, leave your phone at home.
We just want to educate everyone here.
Just listen and learn. Whatever the lesson may be, just learn.
Okay? We do say stay alive. We don't say keep others alive. So
That's true. I like that. So the defense was up next. The defense's strategy, in addition to questioning how a man could do this to mm-hmm. his wife and son, was to try to make the police investigation look sloppy.
Okay.
They elicited testimony that there was no physical evidence tying Alec to the crime scene, no fingerprints taken, and that police efforts to secure the scene and preserve evidence were insufficient. A couple examples were that the police were walking near the crime scene without booties on, their shoes, and that they covered Paul and Maggie's body with sheets rather than tarps, so critical fiber or DNA evidence could have been destroyed.
Which wasn't even necessary, right. Even if that was true.
Right. The defense called 14 witnesses total, and the overall theme was that there was no motive for Alec to kill his wife and son, and the forensic evidence didn't support it. Sure, mm-hmm. Alec was a thief and a liar, but he didn't kill his wife and son. That was the defense.
Oh, okay.
They called an expert witness to testify that there was likely two shooters involved in the double homicide. Timothy Palmbach is a former professor of forensic science at the University of New Haven and an expert in crime scene reconstruction and blood spatter analysis.
Hmm.
Tim Palmbach testified that Paul was shot first by a shotgun and then Maggie was shot by a rifle. He said it was structurally difficult for a shooter to have two long guns on them. And he also opined that because Paul was shot at such close range, the shooter would have been stunned by the explosive violence of the shot, temporarily incapacitating them, which would have tipped the scales in favor of two shooters.
Interesting. I follow the logic.
Mm-hmm.
I am not an expert, so I can't really counter it.
He was only paid $13,000 for his opinion.
Mm-hmm. I could have that opinion, too.
I know, right? I'll say whatever you want. Just kidding. The defense also called a forensic engineer who specialized in ballistic incident reconstruction named Mike Sutton. Mike Sutton testified that the two bullet holes made by the AR-15 that killed Maggie were likely shot by someone between 5'2" and 5'4" based upon the angle of the bullets. Alec was 6'4", so he would have to be bending over or have his shooting hand below his kneecap, which wouldn't make any sense.
Okay.
Mike Sutton also testified that Alec was unlikely to have been able to hear the gunshots if he was home and napping at the time that Paul and Maggie were murdered. He tested the theory at Moselle, and he said you could barely hear the gunshots in the house even when they were all listening for it.
Huh.
The defense also called a forensic pathologist, Dr. Jonathan Eisenstadt, to review the reports of Dr. Ellen Reimer. who was the forensic pathologist for the state.
Okay.
He agreed with Dr. Reimer on 4 of the 5 shots that happened to Maggie, but he believed that one of the shots that Dr. Reimer said went through Maggie's chest and into her brain actually went through her brain and then down into her chest. So he was saying it went in the other direction.
Oh.
He also believed that the shot that killed Paul was a point-blank shot to the back of the head fired downward, not fired upward like she had said. And Dr. Kenneth Kinsey is the one whose testimony I went through.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that summarized all of this, but she was the,
the expert coroner, or
the forensic pathologist, who went through this stuff. He said that the spot where Paul's skull was missing was likely where the shotgun was pressed against his head, and Tim Palmbach agreed with Dr. Eisenstadt's assessment.
Huh.
The defense needed to establish these different opinions concerning the bullet angles in order to make the two-shooter theory work. Right.
That's so aggressive to go with a two-shooter theory, because I feel like you're adding so much more to prove. I don't know.
You are, but maybe that's why Alec used 2 different guns, because why else would you use 2 different guns to do it?
I was thinking about that when you mentioned the AR again, that it was surprising that you would use 2 versus just why not use, because I'm assuming you, okay, we're getting into Laura's lack of knowledge here again, but in the shotgun, would you have to reload or anything?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why.
Yeah, because there's only 2 cartridges and Paul was shot twice. So maybe he just dropped that gun and grabbed another. But
yeah,
he may have also been considering, hey, 2 guns, they're going to think 2 people.
It would be confusing.
Right.
You know? Suspicious.
Interesting. So Alec elected to testify. And at first I thought, man, what a bad idea.
I still think so.
But honestly, he didn't really have a choice. He had to explain the lies he told to police about not being at the dog kennels. Because if he doesn't, he's just a liar with no explanation.
Okay.
If he does testify and the jury don't believe him, well, then he's still a liar, but he tried. Mm. And there's an off chance that he testifies and the jury believes him, right? I mean, it's like a lose-lose-win.
Yeah. Yes. 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 Which way did it go for him?
Lose.
Okay.
The defense came out swinging and asked him point blank out of the gates if he killed Paul or Maggie.
Ooh.
Alec said no, he would never intentionally hurt either of them ever. Interesting choice of words.
Very interesting.
So did he do it unintentionally?
Uh-huh.
Alec straight up admitted to lying to the police. And again, he really had no choice because he got busted.
Totally caught. Yeah.
He got busted. He said he lied because the opiates he took made him paranoid. He said that he had paranoid thoughts and he wasn't thinking clearly. And that's why he lied about being at the kennels. And then once he lied to the police, he just continued to lie. And he said, "What a tangled web we weave."
I would consider believing that, I think, if I were on the jury. Maybe not after sitting through everything else. I don't know. He seems just wishy-washy and I don't know.
He seems like a lawyer.
Yeah, that's true.
He said that he wasn't capable of reason that night and he lied about being down there and he's so sorry that he did.
Mm-hmm. I bet he is.
So sorry. Completely changing his story for the first time, he said that he went to the kennels for a brief time after dinner before coming back home and snoozing on the couch, and then everything else happened the way that he said it did.
Hence whether you could hear gunshots if you're napping.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. And Alec testified that he was addicted to painkillers and that he'd been spending so much money on oxycodone and OxyContin. He originally hurt his knee playing football in college and had a couple of surgeries. He started out taking hydrocodone, but then moved on to Oxy and was addicted quickly. He said he went to a detox facility 3 times and that Maggie and Paul would help him out. He testified later that one of the reasons he didn't pursue being a solicitor in 2006 was because he was already addicted to prescription pills at that time. The black sheep of the family.
Yeah.
Some of his testimony was bizarre. This is an unnecessary tidbit, just cracked me up. So they were discussing Maggie's iPhone, and he said that he'd provided the passcode for the phone and that he knew that there would be GPS data on it. He said he had nothing to hide. He was just trying to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
He said Maggie loved to use the Find My Friends feature and surprise people. His example was that she would see someone was at Walmart and would text them and say, hey, pick me up a TV while you're at Walmart.
That's something I would do.
Is that what rich people do? They're just like, hey, can you grab me a TV while you're at Walmart? Okay,
yeah. I just meant I would be like, yeah, true. I'd be like a pack of Twizzlers,
please. Yeah, can I have Gatorade? Not like, yeah. Grab me a 70-inch Vizio, thank you. Yeah. Alec was asked about his phone records. After the murder, there was a phone call on his phone to a videography services guy that he had used in the past. There was also a group text message that was read, and there was a Safari browser search for a restaurant at the popular restaurant near his family's other home. So they asked him about that activity, and he said that the only thing that he did was call his family and Paul's friends because he didn't want to be alone. He said, I assure you, I wasn't searching for restaurant menus or group text messages or anything that was on my phone. It must have just been an accident when he was fumbling for his phone.
Oh, okay. Maybe a red text message I'll give you.
Yes.
But a search for a restaurant on Safari, I don't think so.
I just wonder what qualifies, and maybe this was in the nitty-gritty of the testimony, but if I opened up an old tab accidentally that had a previous search, would that pop up as a search? Because that I could see happening.
Totally. Yep.
That I could see happening.
Huh.
Not to play devil's advocate for him.
No.
Alec was asked about his finances. In 2019, he made $3.7 million.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
He admitted that the money he stole was used to buy more than just pills, thankfully, because we said that would be so much oxy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And amazing that he couldn't support his lavish lifestyle with a $3.7 million salary.
Well, as we said, I could find a way to outspend that.
Yes, for sure.
I don't think that's what was happening.
He'd also taken out significant loans from a $1 million line of credit at a bank.
Well, I guess I probably have an answer for who did that. Was it by any chance the bank that was also handling his client's money?
That very same one.
Oh, I'm so good.
Russell Lafitte.
Was it really?
Yep.
Wow.
He was the one extending the lines of credit. And using the client funds to extend the loans and shuffle back and forth, you know.
Yep.
Alec tried to downplay his financial issues. He did admit to stealing the money from people who trusted him and said it was wrong, but he said that the quote-unquote confrontation with Jeannie Seckinger on June 7th was not a confrontation at all. He said it was a quick discussion about some legal fees, and then he took the phone call, and he said it wasn't even really a cause for concern for him. And this is what impacts his credibility for me. Because his reason to lying to the police was that the opioid pills made him paranoid, especially when he thought that someone was going to question him about his addiction. So you're telling me that the CFO of the firm is questioning you about legal fees that you stole to fund your opioid addiction.
Uh-huh.
And that's no big deal.
You read my mind, even on any of the other points he's made where he's downplayed something.
Yeah.
But conveniently, when we're talking about your alleged alibi for a murder, well, that's when you were paranoid.
Right.
No, I'm totally with you on that.
Like that, he should have been like, yeah, I was super concerned, but it didn't make me kill my family. Like he just should have, I don't know, leaned into it more.
Yep.
He also downplayed any concern for the impending financial disclosure that he may have had to make on June 10th.
Also stupid, though, because that was your motive.
Right.
Or your, you know, fine.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
He said his bigger concern was the motion concerning the change of venue and that he had just worked on the financial declaration already and it was ready to go for that hearing. Mm-hmm. NBD.
Mm-hmm.
On cross-examination, the state went hard at his new timeline that he established for first time at trial. Yep. They must have said that 79 times. Alec said that he went back out to the kennels that night because Maggie had asked him to go. He said he didn't want to because he'd already showered and he didn't want to get all sweaty again, but then he decided to go. Also, remember, he forgot when he changed. He couldn't remember. Yeah. He must have changed when he went back to the house.
He's all of it.
A liar.
Yeah.
And the state also pointed out, like, look at how easily you just put all those lies together about any of these pieces. Like, it just flows out of you so easily.
Mm-hmm.
The state asked him why he changed his mind, and he said just because Maggie had asked him. Mm-hmm. So he wanted to go because she asked him.
And just ignore that testimony about her telling her sister that the reason that Maggie was even on the property was because of Alec.
Right.
Yeah, we'll ignore that part.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And then throughout all of his testimony, Alec referred to Maggie as Mags and Paul as Pawpaw.
Are you kidding me?
And the state pointed out that he had never referred to them using those names during any interviews with investigators, and I found it appalling. It was definitely a sympathy grab. Now, they did have those nicknames. They were Mags and Pawpaw.
It was appalling.
It was appalling. It was.
I'm so sorry.
No pun intended.
No, okay, please.
It was appalling.
I'm sorry. I've got to laugh. I have to.
I know.
Okay, please continue.
One of the housekeeper, Gloria, called him Pawpaw. Like, people did call him Pawpaw.
People who actually cared, right?
Yes. Ugh. But he didn't when he was talking about them in the interviews with police. He never called them that. And that's, like, all he called them during the testimony was Mags and Pawpaw.
It's like he looked up what would make me seem less guilty. Right. I should try doing that. But
what's
even
sympathetic?
Like, an actual person, even if you had a nickname, you would most likely not say that during a murder trial.
Right.
You know, you just wouldn't. I just don't think that would have even been appropriate had he not been guilty.
Right. I agree.
Yeah.
He also seemed to be much more emotional when talking about Pawpaw than he did about Maggie. I read an article that said Maggie had consulted a divorce attorney a few weeks before her murder and that she was looking into their finances to determine the extent of their marital estate for the divorce.
Oh.
But that was disputed by those closest to Alec. I didn't see anything confirming that, but it could explain some of the reactions to them.
Absolutely.
Or it could have just been that it was his son versus his wife and his injuries were more brutal. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Alec said he drove the family golf cart down to the kennels. He said he wasn't at the kennels long before the Snapchat video was shot. He said he stayed on the golf cart and the dog Bubba ran up with the chicken that he had caught very proudly, showing it to his papa. Alec said, "Come here, Bubba," and took the chicken out of his mouth. He said he got right out of there after that because he didn't want to get all hot and sweaty.
Right. Or be connected with murder.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or be at the scene of the crime when it happened.
Yep.
He said he went back to the house and he must have dozed off. He never heard any gunshots. And then he left to see his mom at 9:02.
And none of it makes sense.
No.
Just none of it.
The state was like, how lucky for you to have missed the murders.
Literally.
Just a few minutes.
Yeah.
How lucky. And the state said that the only reason that Alec was admitting to any of this was because he got caught.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
The only reason he admitted to the financial crimes is because he got caught. Mm-hmm. And now the only reason he's admitting to being at the kennels and explaining it is because he got caught.
Ugh.
Alec maintained on the stand that he thought the 2019 boat wreck had something to do with the murders. He didn't think that any of the teenagers were involved, but that it was someone who had heard something about it. Creighton Waters asked, "What you're telling me is that it is a random vigilante?" And Alec said, "That's your term." And let me just say, Alec testified so much like a lawyer. I mean, he could help it since he is a lawyer.
Yeah.
But when asked questions, he would say, "Well, as you heard X witness say," or "I have no reason to doubt that what you're reading from is the truth." Like phrases and things that just a normal person wouldn't say. Like it was very lawyerly. The jury must have hated him.
Absolutely. Because you just want a yes or no.
Right.
You know, to try to make sense of it all.
Right. And then Alec's brother, John Marvin Murdoch, was the last person to testify for the defense. He said that he went to the crime scene at the dog kennels that night and it hadn't been cleaned up.
Oh.
He said, "I saw blood. I saw brains. Oh. I saw pieces of skull." He was crying and he said, "For some reason, I thought it was something that I needed to do for Paul to clean it up. I felt like it was the right thing to do. I felt like I owed him and I started cleaning." "I can promise you no mother or father or aunt or uncle should ever have to see and do what I did that day."
Oh, that poor, poor guy.
He said he made a promise to Paul to find whoever did this, and he hasn't found that person yet.
Oh, interesting.
That's quite a dramatic way to close out your case.
It is.
So the defense rested their case, and for what it's worth, solid effort trying to plant reasonable doubt in the jury's mind with the two-shooter theory and the issue with the shooter being shorter than Alec was, say that
shorter
10 times
shooter.
Fast. Yeah. Not bad, you know? Just trying to plant those little seeds.
Yep.
The state has the burden, so they have the final say, so they got to do a rebuttal case. After the defense's case, they called a crime scene forensics expert, again, Dr. Kenneth Kinsey, who criticized the methodology of Mike Sutton, who was the one who commented about the shooter's height.
Yep.
Kinsey said there were too many variables to determine the shooter's height with any certainty. And then he also criticized Tim Palmbach's testimony, saying that the analysis was preposterous.
Was that the one that said it went in the different direction?
The two shooters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The state also called two attorneys who worked with Murdoch, a local sheriff, and the pathologist who conducted the autopsies to respond to the points made during the defense's case. The prosecution rested, and then came closing arguments. The state's closing argument lasted more than 3 hours.
Oh my God.
That is so intense.
You know, after hour two, you've lost people, honestly.
I would be enthralled to listen to okay, him.
You've lost most people.
But to just go through, I mean, there's true. So much information.
Yeah.
This state said Alec was a family annihilator and someone mm-hmm. who was facing complete ruin. He said the defendant fooled everyone. He fooled Maggie and Paul, too, mm-hmm. and they paid for it with their lives. Don't let him fool you, too.
Oh, so good.
Attorney Jim Griffin delivered the closing for Alec. He argued that Sled's investigation was insufficient, and had they done a better job, Alec wouldn't be a suspect. Jim admitted again that Alec lied. He said he's an addict. That's what addicts do. Addicts lied. He lied because he had a closet full of skeletons that he didn't want any more scrutiny on him. That doesn't make him a killer. He concluded on behalf of Alec, on behalf of Buster, on behalf of Maggie, and on behalf of my friend Paul, I respectfully request you do not compound a family tragedy with another.
Okay, on the comment on he's a liar, that's what addicts do, where was that in your opening? Where was that prior to coming into the court and being caught?
Well, they did address the lies about the dog kennel.
But his whole entire alibi? With the video and the timelines and everything being shot to shit.
Well, not all. I don't think they addressed all of it, but they did address the video with the dogs.
Fine.
To a certain extent.
Yeah.
On rebuttal, Prosecutor John Meters argued, how can you believe him on the ultimate issue when the only thing corroborated to you throughout this trial, throughout this investigation, and throughout the cross-examination is that he's a liar?
Yup.
And that's all you can judge people on. He said, I think he loved Maggie, I think he loved Paul, but you know who he loved more than that? He loved Alec, and he exercised his greatest power of choice to make sure that that life continued.
Ooh, that gave me chills. Uh-huh.
That is hashtag deep.
Yup.
The trial lasted more than 28 days with more than 70 witnesses, and on March 2nd, 2023, the jury found Alec guilty on all counts in less than 3 hours.
Yes. That was me pounding my fist.
Yas, queen.
Yes.
Less than 3 hours.
Oh, damn.
Can you imagine putting on a month-long case as the defense and it takes them less than 3 hours to sink your client?
It's kind of when I cook a really intense and delicious dinner and then my husband's done eating it in about 3 minutes. So yes, I can imagine.
Worth it. The prosecutor said that the jury saw through the one last con that Alec was trying to pull. The defense attorney said the case ultimately came down to the big lie. Alec lying about being near the kennels around the time Maggie and Paul died against the big why, with the state trying to prove a motive for the murders.
Yep.
At his sentencing, Alec spoke and said, I would never hurt my wife, Maggie, and I would never hurt my son, Pawpaw.
Intentionally.
The judge asked Alec what he meant when he testified, saying, what a tangled web we weave. Alec said he meant that once he had lied, he had to continue to lie. The judge asked, when will that end?
Ooh. Yes.
Alec was sentenced to 2 life terms to be served consecutively, and his appeal is pending.
Wow.
We have a loose end to tie up here. I didn't finish talking about the boat case.
Oh my God.
That's where it all began. So obviously the criminal charges against Paul for the boat wreck were dropped on August 6, 2021, based upon his death.
Yeah.
In September 2021, Connor Cook filed a lawsuit against Alec Buster Parkers and the store clerk working at Parkers. Mm. His lawsuit made the usual claims for negligence against Alec and Buster, but also pointed out that Alec had started that whisper campaign against him to shift blame and told him to hire Corey Fleming to protect Connor criminally without disclosing his connections.
Yup.
Attorney Mark Tinsley's lawsuit was originally filed against Alec Buster and Parker's convenience store in February 2022 after Paul and Maggie's death. Attorney Tinsley filed an amended complaint adding the estates of Paul and Maggie to the lawsuit. Alec's brother, John Marvin Murdoch, was the representative for Maggie's estate, and Randy Murdoch was the representative for Paul's estate. And in February 2022, Attorney Tinsley also filed lawsuits against Maggie and Paul's estate on behalf of Morgan Dowdy and Miley Altman, who were the two other girls on the boat. At this point, Attorney Tinsley has settled the lawsuit pending against Buster and Maggie's estate given the circumstances.
Okay.
Maggie's estate had accrued $290,000 in attorney's fees, which would only continue to increase as litigation continued.
Of course.
And the more fees that accrued, the less money there would be for the victims, whether they won or lost.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark Tinsley agreed to settle with her estate as a practical matter and let Buster out at the same time given the loss of his mother and brother. The judge approved of the settlement agreement over Parker's objection. Moselle was held in Maggie's name.
Oh.
Her last will and testament left her property and assets to Alec upon her death.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Had Alec predeceased her, her estate would have gone to her sons.
Mm-hmm.
Alec executed a qualified disclaimer of his interest in the estate on March 7th, 2022. But the individuals who were appointed to receive property on behalf of Alec and Buster objected on the basis that a judge had previously issued an injunction preventing Alec from transferring or encumbering any of his assets.
I may need you to translate a little bit here.
Let me get through the rest okay. and then we'll go over it.
Okay.
So if Alec's qualified disclaimer was valid, then Alec would be treated as having predeceased Maggie and the property would go to Buster. If Alec was convicted of killing Maggie, which he was, then legally he predeceased her and the property would go to Buster. So the final agreement overall was that Buster would receive the property and sell it. And this was on the basis that Alec wouldn't object to it.
Wow. Okay. So it's just like you said, legally predeceased. So the equivalent of having died.
Yes. Like considered to be dead.
Yep. I got it now. Yep.
And the agreement also required that the Murdoch Mercedes be signed over to Mark Tinsley to be sold.
That seems like such small potatoes compared to everything else.
Which, I mean, $50,000, though, I mean, it's money, you know?
Yes.
It's money.
Sure.
Liquidating the estate meant that about $2.7 million will go to Mallory Beach's family. Connor Cook will get about $100,000. Buster will receive about $500,000. And $300,000 will go to legal fees and a settlement fund for creditors and financial victims of Alec Murdoch.
That feels good.
And the lawsuit against Alec, Paul's estate, and Parker's is still pending and is set for trial in August 2023.
Why do I feel like that has to just be a roller coaster ride, even though it should be straightforward?
I know. I know.
Wow.
So final thoughts.
Holy shit. Those are my final thoughts. I'm so glad. I'm sure you also have final thoughts, but I'm so glad I didn't know anything about this that I held and didn't watch anything, because it was so much better listening to it unfold the way that you presented it versus knowing what happened.
So dramatic. When I watched the Netflix series, yeah. Every time something happened, you're like, what? And he got shot in the head?
That was how I felt. Yeah. Like,
everything was wild.
Wow.
So I think that if Paul had not shot that Snapchat video,
I think
Alec would have gotten away with it.
I think so too. Because I think you would have, I don't know that I actually think, maybe. Okay, so but there was still all the evidence on his cell phone, on Alec's cell phone, about where he went and where he was. Didn't they have proof that he was at Moselle? Moselle, right.
He was at Moselle, but he always said he was at Moselle. He said he was napping inside. His cell phone wasn't with him from 8 to 9:02. There was no activity. There was that flurry of activity between 9 and 9:02 or whatever.
But he
didn't have his cell phone with him. So the only thing that placed him near
Like
close enough to the shootings was that Snapchat video.
Damn.
And they interviewed some of the jurors. And at the onset of deliberations, the jurors took an anonymous poll to see where they stood. And 9 off the bat said Murdoch was guilty. 2 said not guilty. And 1 was undecided. And after they talked through their concerns, all decided to convict him.
Wow.
And they said the key piece of evidence that swayed them was the Snapchat video.
Yep.
And they said that it was like Paul was speaking to them from the grave.
Ooh, I was thinking that like that was his last like, wow.
And the other thing that I actually kind of love this journey for him, is that in order to try to save his ass on this murder charge, Alec had to get up and admit under oath this slew of financial crimes that they can use against him in his other trials.
Oh.
Because he admitted it under oath.
So fucked. And should be.
Yes.
And should be.
But yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
What an insane ride.
I know.
Tragic. Like, let's not obviously forget about that, because it's just, there were lives lost that never should have been lost, and just people are terrible.
And it's really hard because it starts off with the Mallory Beach case.
Right.
So you're hating. You're hating right. Paul and of Maggie. Course.
Yeah.
But this was a mother and a son.
Yep.
And he had a life. Oh, so my thought was, you know, I don't think that the financials were enough of a motive.
I agree
think
completely.
There was something else at play. I do think it's much more likely to make sense to me if their marriage was on the rocks mm-hmm. and she was considering divorce and she was going to look through their marital assets. And then you made the point that if Paul wasn't there, it's less likely that the lawsuit would continue Absolutely. Against him out of a sympathy thing.
Right.
So I think it was more than just he didn't want to disclose his financials. I think there was a lot for him in his mind to gain.
Yep.
But I think he's a sociopath. And I also, I don't know that he meant to kill both of them. I wonder if Paul was his intended target and he thought that Maggie might be far enough away or...
No, I don't think
so. Oh, no, no, because he asked her to call.
Yeah. But I also, like, as much as I was so mad at Paul, and I was mad at Paul for what he did, his actions were not precalculated. He was not attempting to kill anyone.
No, he was just a dick.
He's an idiot and irresponsible and still absolutely responsible for Mallory's death.
Right.
But... not in the same way that
he was a drunk, spoiled rich kid. He wasn't a sociopath
exactly
who set out to kill someone.
Although no surprise, that's who Alec would raise.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
Wow. What an insane case.
Insane.
Oh, sorry. I hit the microphone.
Crazy insane or insane crazy? When I say Hussein, you say shady.
Thank you. I couldn't get the next line.
If you're enjoying listening to Grimm, please rate and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts and make sure you don't miss any episodes. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, make our day by leaving us a written review. It's been a while, guys. Come on, make our day. Cheer us up. We love it. You can find our page on Facebook by searching Grimm : A True Crime Podcast. If you want to subscribe to our Patreon, you can go to Patreon and search Grimm : A True Crime Podcast. Follow us on Instagram at Grimm Crime Podcast for information on future episodes and case photos. If you want to send us a case suggestion or just say hi, you can email us at grimmcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Listen, learn, and stay alive until next time because the future is grim. We'll be right back.